1 p.m. Central on Mondays. This program comes to you from Montreal, Canada. It's an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our guests today on very important issues. In the first hour, Tom Burkhardt, author, analyst of the National Security State, who has just come up with a very incisive article entitled Spying on Americans, Democrats Ready to Gut the Constitution. And Tom raises the issues pertaining to the privatization of security or spying through the telecoms. Very controversial issue, but also very timely because the U.S. Congress has, in fact, adopted legislation which modifies fundamentally the rights of Americans and grants the U.S. administration the possibility to actually spy on U.S. citizens. And in the second hour, we'll have Professor Peter Phillips of the University of California at Sonoma. I'm welcoming our first guest, Tom Burkhardt, who is joining us from the Bay Area. Good morning, or Tom.
Good morning, Michelle.
Well,
thanks for having me on.
You have produced a very extensive analysis on this question of the spy, the domestic spy apparatus. How serious is this in terms of basic fundamental constitutional rights?
Well, it completely subverts any notion of individual freedom or any constitutional rights. If you look at what's called Bush's terrorist surveillance program, they're not just spying on Al-Qaeda or other terrorist organizations. They're basically what the National Security Agency, which is probably the largest intelligence organization inside the U.S. government, they're able to literally listen in on your telephone calls, on your internet communications. They do what is called data mining, whereby they use commercially available databases to, they could look at, you know, all of your financial records, basically what your travel plans are, where you've been, how you spend your money. So it's a rather extensive surveillance apparatus that's already in place. It's not what they're proposing to do. It's what they've been doing and will continue to do.
There's been some discussion of this, of the so-called FISA legislation in the U.S. Congress, which is barely a couple of, it's barely a month old, the whole discussion. Is spying on Americans, is that illegal, or is it something which now is permitted under prevailing legislation?
Oh, it's absolutely permitted. What it does, it basically has given the Bush administration a blank check to continue their spy operations. What the legislation does, many people have focused on the issue of telecom immunity, which is which is very important. Giant telecommunications providers, internet service providers, knew that these programs basically gut Fourth Amendment protections, that the government needs some reasonable means to be able to, look at what you're doing.
I think we'll have to go to commercial break, Tom.
All right.
We'll be back after the break with our guest, Tom Burkhardt.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chassadovsky. Our program comes to you from Montreal. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest this morning is Tom Burkhardt, who is a specialist on issues of homeland security. He's investigated the recent changes in legislation pertaining to freedom of citizens to communicate, and the fact that we are now virtually in a police state environment where Big Brother, Bush administration, can spy on Americans, and they can do it through existing procedures. And this also is applied through the telecoms. Tom, the role of the telecoms in this process is extremely, I presume, is extremely ambiguous. They are in fact complicit, are they not?
Oh, they're absolutely complicit. And frankly, this is nothing new. During the 1970s, the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church's commission that looked at CIA and other intelligence abuses, discovered that the nascent National Security Agency basically have been spying on our communications since the 1940s under a program called Project Shamrock. And then telephone communications that went overseas, telegrams and the like, basically were scooped up and under Project Shamrock were provided to the government. So this is nothing new for these companies. It's been a matter of policy for them to do so, as I say, since the 1940s. What's changed today is that it's not just, it's not just your telephone calls, it's your internet communications.
It's everything.
Literally, they're cloning the internet, and they can data mine the entire internet if they so chose.
And I presume they can also, they know the whereabouts of people because from their cell phones they can trace the exact movements through GPS. Is that correct?
That's also one technology that's coming online, and in fact there was a controversy. I think there was a piece in the London Guardian about a week or 2 weeks ago where there was an issue of that, of whether, MI5 was going to be able to track people. I forget what the name of the program is, through their cell phones. So I mean, these are not just some insane sort of conspiracy theory. This is what the technology allows them to do. And I'd also like to add, we're looking at an intelligence apparatus that's already 70% of all United States intelligence agencies, their employees are private contractors. 70%.
So in other words, what we're also dealing with is the privatization of this domestic spying apparatus.
On a massive scale.
And I presume that this is a multi-billion dollar deal for the telecoms, because they will be on contract to the government or to the various government agencies to provide them with information that they can canvass through advanced technologies, and then they sell that information.
Absolutely, and it also raises a very disturbing question. If you're a corporation and you're making tens of billions of dollars a year by contracting out your services to the government, how objective is your analysis going to be? Are you going to suddenly say, the terrorist threat is diminished, or are you going to hype that so that you can...
Of course. What you would do is you'd hype it. You say there are 270 million terrorists in America.
Exactly.
And then you build a government for that for on a pro rata basis.
Exactly. In fact, there was an article that came out several months ago. I think it was on Secrecy News, which is run by the Federation of American Scientists, where they had received some documents. Basically, they were each telecommunications company basically are charging $1,000 per wiretap, and the rate went down to $750. So this is per, let's say, phone line or, you know, whatever it is they're surveilling at the moment. So it's a very big business. It's a very big business. And when you have 70% of the intelligence that's being done by the United States government in private hands through private contractors, how objective can that be?
Well, that's an important question. I think from the broader point of view, let's say American citizens, the question is, how does the U.S. Congress respond to this, to these developments? And if we go back to mid-June when we had, and you've covered it in your articles,
uh-huh.
when we had debate in the U.S. Congress, essentially, if I read correctly your analysis, is that the congressional leaders, particularly the Democrats, but everybody, have agreed to maintaining, in fact, to even announcing this surveillance system, because they've given immunity to the telecoms and they've also allowed the program to go ahead with maybe some sort of formal safeguards.
Well, what's even more disturbing is that many of the same Democrats, including Obama, they initially opposed any reauthorization of the program. They completely caved in for their own reasons. Under the legislation that was passed, this is how ludicrous the entire thing is. All that the executive branch, meaning Bush and Cheney, et cetera, have to say is that these are exigent circumstances, urgent circumstances. They can bypass even the minimal safeties that were provided by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court or the FISA Court. And the Democrats have been completely complicit in this. And if you look at the top leaders, people like Steny Hoyer, Pelosi, et cetera, they've received tens of thousands of dollars in lobbying money from the very same companies that they're supposed to regulate.
Now, who is, let's discuss, who is being targeted by this surveillance apparatus?
It could be anyone. Certain revelations that came out several years ago, there was one Pentagon program called the Counterintelligence Field Activity. They were targeting anti-war activists in a number of states. They were targeting Muslim communities. They were targeting environmental activists and literally running, whole spy operations on various dissident groups. But the program itself is so broad that it could target anyone.
And I presume it may also target members of Congress who are who are a little bit going against the stream, right?
Absolutely. You know, I have it's pretty interesting. Now, there was a analysis done by this watchdog group called MapLight in the Bay Area, and they broke down the contributions from various PACs from Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint. This covers a period of 3 years. All of the leaders in the Democratic Party who voted for the so-called FISA compromise legislation received $30,000 or more from the very PACs and, from the very companies that they're supposed to be regulating.
I mean, they received $30,000 or more in terms of campaign contributions. Is that it?
In terms of campaign contributions
it wasn't
from
just
a political
handout.
Action committees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it really renders the whole concept of...
But my question was, assuming that there are congressmen who oppose this type of thing, we know who they are.
Well, it's quite possible that they're targeted. Who knows,
Are they being subjected to surveillance simply because they oppose the Bush administration or they oppose the Homeland Security? Within the dissidents within the Democratic Party, people like Dennis Kucinich, Wexler,
one can only assume that they are.
Pardon?
You can only assume that they are.
Yeah, we don't know that.
Based on how this administration operates. I don't have any proof that they are, but one can only assume based on how, the Bush administration has operated for the last 7.5 years.
Yeah. Well, this is all very disturbing. I remember a few years ago there was this these top officials anti-terrorist exercises. You recall that?
I do.
Yeah, it was run by Homeland Security, and these were simulations, but they had identified three types of domestic enemies. One were, of course, the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists. The second were disgruntled employees, and the third were radical groups. Now, how does that tie in to your understanding? The disgruntled employees, I think we'll have to go, in fact, to a commercial break.
And we can pick it up, yeah.
Yeah, we'll pick it after the break. We're talking to Tom Burkhardt.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. I'm Michel Chasadovsky. Our guest is Tom Burkhardt, who is based in the San Francisco Bay Area and is informing us on some very important issues pertaining to the Constitution of the United States and the ability and also the legitimacy under congressional manipulation of the Bush administration to spy on American citizens. Welcome back, Tom. We were discussing the categories of people who might be identified, and these, in fact, as you suggest, have already been identified.
Oh, I believe they have, and if we go back to the article you wrote about a month ago, back in June, about National Security Presidential Directive 59, NSPD 59, these categories have been identified, and foreign Islamic terrorists, domestic radical groups, state-sponsored adversaries, and disgruntled employees, which is a very interesting category indeed. Does that include activists, let's say, trying to unionize some giant retail outlet or, Walmart or...
or maybe people at the grassroots of the AFL-CIO.
Exactly.
Not necessarily the leaders. But when you look at these three categories, in fact, the Islamic terrorists are thrown in there just for the appearances because they don't constitute a threat they're not challenging the U.S. government. They're proxies there to provide a pretext.
In many cases, they have been proxies. I think your own research and also the research of other journalists, amply documented that. Whether we look at the situation in the Balkans in the 1990s under a democratic administration, or in Chechnya, or in any number of countries, in Pakistan, for that matter, these groups have served as intelligence assets, witting or unwitting.
But they have provided, if we go back, let's say, to 2001, and the implementation of Patriot legislation, they have provided the pretext and the justification for what we are living today, which is the national security state and a much more cohesive apparatus, which in fact now has the ability and the mandate to spy on Americans.
Oh, absolutely. And a good analogy to what's going on today would be the situation, let's say, during the Cold War period, where the enemy was then identified as socialists, Marxists, you know, the Soviet Union, domestic communists, you know, for the CIA's Operation Chaos or the FBI's COINTELPRO program. The enemy changes, but the state remains.
But I mean, if you say disgruntled employee, everybody in the United States potentially is disgruntled, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, look at the gas prices going up. Now, if you start saying I'm against setting up picket lines in front of the gas stations, would you be considered a disgruntled citizen or employee? I presume
well,
so.
Yeah, or if you go out to the Chevron plant here in Richmond and picket because they're polluting your community, does that make you an urban terrorist?
But this surveillance apparatus is not applied against the corporations which are in fact responsible for pollution or responsible for whatever it may be, financial manipulation in the stock market or whatever. This is not a national security state which has some kind of a mandate to establish a social order which will function. It's chaotic at the same time because they're not addressing fundamental violations by the corporate sector.
No, in fact, they're protecting the corporate sector. It's a corporatist state. The best analogy that I could draw to what exists today would be something that existed in Italy, under the fascists, under Mussolini. However, we have the appearance that we have elections, we're able to vote for different candidates, you can say what you want, et cetera, but if you look at it, it's really the integration of the state by the military, by militarists, by giant defense corporations. That's whose Congress's real constituents are. They're the multinational corporations.
I should mention to our listeners, Tom Burkhardt has a website. It's called Anti-Fascist Calling. The web address is antifascist-calling.blogspot.com, which you can visit, and his various publications and articles are there. He's also a regular contributor to Global Research at www.globalresearch.ca. How should we address this issue in terms of debate, discussion? What measures can be taken to reverse the tide? We'll have to go to a commercial break again, and we'll discuss those issues after the break. This is Michel Chostodovsky. Our guest is Tom Burkhardt, who is discussing with us crucial issues of human rights, civil rights, and the right to privacy in America. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chostodovsky. This program comes to you from Montreal, Canada. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest from the San Francisco Bay Area is Tom Burkhardt, who is a distinguished author and analyst of the national security state and its implications on the constitutional rights of American citizens. Welcome back, Tom. We were, I think, discussing this very broadly, and at the break, I asked you the question, what can be done to reverse the tide? and restore these fundamental rights.
Personally, I believe the most important thing that people can do is to, first of all, speak out, contact their congressional representatives, say they don't like this, that they want it to stop. They need to, you know, people need to be in the street. In order to challenge the national security state, we need a mass anti-war movement that really needs to be more active than it has been over the last few years. Unfortunately, I think too many people are placing their hopes on the Democratic Party taking the White House, on Barack Obama. This is not how change occurs. Change occurs through social movements, through mass democratic organizations. And personally, I really feel that the only way that we can go beyond the current paradigm is if there is a mass opposition in this country, and also, you know, across Europe, across Canada. They're not going to listen to the congressional representatives. And I came across a disturbing article, I guess, about a week ago, where, people who are planning to protest at the Democratic Convention, they're going to be spied on by NORTHCOM. I don't know how many people are aware of what NORTHCOM is, but it's the North American Command that's run out of Colorado. So here again,
It's the military division which protects the homeland against foreign aggression. That's
exactly
really its mandate.
And it's
so this is a domestic issue.
Oh, it's incredibly important. You know, the domestic spying apparatus is in place, and now again, it's going to be turned on citizens who come out in protest.
But isn't that really what we might describe the militarization of domestic civilian institutions, law enforcement, and so on? The fact that the military now controls the domestic judicial, or is in the process of controlling the domestic judicial and civilian law enforcement apparatus.
This is a trend that's been going on for, 20 years. When the first SWAT teams came on the scene, what were they modeled after? They were modeled after special forces teams, U.S. Green Berets. You know, we can not only is law enforcement being militarized, but the entire society, research itself, is being militarized. If you look at, let's say, behavioral psychology and now neuroscience, research is being transformed into a branch of the Pentagon. Basic medical research, basic scientific research. These are all branches of, devising new weapons for conquest and control.
That brings us to your more recent research on the militarization of science and the whole issue of neuroscience, which you covered in a very recent article on your website, Anti-Fascist Calling, but also which we published on Global Research. I remind our readers it's a most incisive piece of research. It's entitled Neuroscience, National Security, and the War on Terror. Can you give us some insights on this process, which I think is far-reaching?
Well, if you look at the latest trends in Pentagon research through an agency called DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, what they're trying to do, they're trying to devise a scheme to basically understand how the mind works, use those processes to devise a computer programs and algorithms in order basically to build, robo-soldiers. It's most disturbing, in fact, because it's actually the mind itself that's now become an object of, you know, Pentagon weapons research. That's really, you know, the best way that I could describe it. It's not mind control per se. We could have a debate over whether such technologies are available or whether they're in use. But I think what's more disturbing is that the same techniques that could, let's say, aid someone suffering from Parkinson's disease could also be used to build what they describe as the perfect soldier.
But it has other applications as well, I presume.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, for instance, could they, and this has been discussed, it's not strictly mind control, but it's mind interference, the fact that and they use them in demonstrations where they target people, and this creates buzzing in their ears, for instance.
Well, exactly. Those fall under the heading of non-lethal weapons, and that's in quotation marks, where they can direct microwaves. In fact, a system built by, I believe it's Raytheon, called the Advanced Defense System, has already been deployed in Iraq. It's basically a microwave weapon mounted on a Humvee that will direct a beam of microwaves that creates a sensation of burning on one's skin. And these weapons are already under development. And as I say, a primitive version of it has been deployed in Iraq. And has been used in Iraq against the Iraqi people, you know, demonstrating against the occupation.
But could they do it also against people who demonstrate against against war, for instance?
Well, they could use it. I believe there's one or two instances where the actual system appeared in Washington D.C. during an anti-war demonstration, but I don't believe it was actually used.
But the technology is available.
The technology is available. It's being actively developed.
And how does
There's a whole slew of these systems.
Yeah. But then it also raises another issue. I mean, you pointed in our earlier discussion to the fact that congressmen who supported the FISA legislation were rewarded through campaign contributions by the telecoms.
Exactly.
Now, if we're looking at the sciences, which is conducted in the universities, neuroscience, computer science, robotics, etc., I presume that corporations as well as the government could mold the way in which university professors do their research, okay? In what areas?
They have been doing that for 50 years. They've been doing that since the Cold War.
Particularly in the advanced physical sciences, I presume.
Exactly. You know,
because there's all the military applications.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a similar trend now in the life sciences, especially, you know, in the science, neuroscience, and also in the social sciences.
Well, absolutely, in the social sciences, everybody is talking about anti-terrorism, and they're looking at ethnic groups and how the Muslims are different from us, etc., etc. There's a whole new trend in sociology and political science, governance.
Exactly.
They're not really, very few political scientists are addressing the issues of the war, for instance. And the economists are certainly not addressing the issue of the economic crisis and the impact on people across America.
No, they're not. And actually, the latest trend, there was a piece in the Washington Post that just appeared yesterday, the Pentagon, they're setting up what they call the Minerva Research Institute, and it's a $50 million initiative to basically place anthropologists and sociologists within, you know, to integrate them within military units, and this is being done right now. In fact, they're called The name escapes me at the moment. There's a Pentagon program that's called the Human Terrain System. And these specialists have been placed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these are anthropologists and sociologists. And what they study are basically the cultures of the people who are being occupied.
And conquered.
And telling, and basically letting, you know, the military know how better to occupy different countries.
Because that is nothing new. It goes back to the British Empire.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's also the way in which it's done.
Well, what's interesting is that one Pentagon analyst, in fact, they did a whole study where they're basically comparing the current program and saying that, you know, we need to bring back the Phoenix program, which also, which they used in Vietnam basically to target insurgent groups. So we see across the board, it's not just the militarization of the physical sciences, physics, but, you know, the militarization of medical science and now social science project of domination and control.
Yeah, and I think that also has a very serious impact on the articulation, let's say, of the anti-war movement, because I was struck recently how the U.S. anti-war movement said, oh, we're against the war, but we support the war on terrorism. So that they, in fact, they've swallowed all the assumptions of the Bush administration with regard to waging a war on terrorism, and they don't see that this is, in fact, a pretext for waging a war, a broader war.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can't on the one hand say that you're opposed to the invasion of Iraq and then turn around and say, well, Afghanistan is a quote-unquote good war because we're fighting al-Qaeda, when in fact, if you know, the dichotomy and the disconnect here is that the Bush administration, if they were fighting a war on terror, then why did they allow Osama bin Laden and his minions to escape into Pakistan? So, I mean, people, unfortunately, a lot of people within the anti-war movement are not even addressing these issues or looking at these questions in any serious way.
But that also brings you into the understanding of 9/11, I presume.
Well, it does. You know, I'm not a proponent that 9/11 was an inside job, let's say. You know, there are a lot of people who would no doubt disagree with me saying that. But there are so many unanswered questions about exactly what happened, what led to 9/11, what happened since 9/11. That the only conclusion I can come to is that the Bush administration is indeed engaged in a massive cover-up. And I, personally, my view of the 9/11 cover-up is not so much that, you know, Bush and Cheney engineered the attack on New York and Washington, but that they were covering up their utilization of these Islamic extreme right-wing fundamentalist groups as intelligence assets.
Well, it's a complex, a very complex issue, because in fact, when you say it's an inside job, one has to really understand all the mechanics. But if
exactly.
Just the fact that there's complicity and cover-up, I think points in that direction. Now, the thing is that we have a lot more understanding of 9/11 than we had, a few years ago.
Well, yeah, we do.
Well, this is extremely important. I remind our listeners, we're talking to Tom Burkhardt, who's has written extensively on issues of national security, the broader issue of spying on Americans, the role of the telecoms. We'll shortly be going, I think we've got just a minute or so before the next commercial break. How do you see Obama in 30 seconds in relation to some of these issues?
Well,
how would he react? Oh, he's a senator. Well, he still is a senator, but...
Well, I really don't see any fundamental change coming on the horizon from Barack Obama. What we might see is that there might be some marginal rhetorical changes, let's say, in how Obama operates. But I don't think fundamentally there's going to be any change in how the actual national security state functions. Is he going to close down Bush's illegal spying programs? No. Is he going to pull the troops out of Iraq? That's doubtful. Is he going to deploy, let's say, tens of thousands of more troops to Afghanistan? Probably. So I think the change we're going to see is going to be more rhetoric than actual, than actually anything that's going to change the tenor and direction of U.S. policy. So, do I place a lot of hopes in Obama? No.
And that gets back to the main areas of social action, which is to develop a mass movement across America, not just street demonstrations, but a network of people across the land, who question the legitimacy of this Big Brother mentality. We'll be back after the break with our guest, Tom Burkhardt, on issues of spying on America and fundamental civil rights. Stay with us. This is Michel Chostodowski. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chostodowski. The program comes to you from Montreal, Canada. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest from the San Francisco Bay Area is Tom Burkhardt, distinguished analyst and author. His website is called Anti-Fascist Calling, which is a very suggestive designation, because essentially he's looking at how the United States is evolving towards a corporate police state. The web address is antifascist-calling.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the program, Tom. We've got just about 3 or 4 minutes left. I see from your recent writings that you are analyzing some of these DARPA technologies in the war theater. In fact, I think what is striking is the fact that they're using the same schemes to control Americans on the one hand and control the war theater on the other, with new weapons systems and so on and so forth. Can you tell us something a little bit about this process of robotization of the war theater and how it's applied, let's say, in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the technologies that they're exploring, they describe it as achieving total situational analysis, which means that through sensor technology, spy satellites, unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, they're able to control what they term the battle space, so that they know exactly what, so that they have a picture of what's going on within any locale that they're occupying or attacking. Of course, we've seen in Iraq that all of these schemes, which basically have evolved from Rumsfeld's so-called revolution in military affairs, have been a failure. You know, here you have these multi-billion-dollar weapon systems and sensors and tracking and satellites and UAVs being defeated by people who have a cell phone or an automatic garage door opener able to explode a 30-year-old ordnance under their high-tech tanks and, Bradley fighting vehicles, etc. So Whereas the ideology and the philosophy behind these things is that through electronics, through computers, through sensing and tracking devices and satellites, as I've said previously, they're able to achieve a battlefield awareness. These schemes have gone to ground. You know, you see in Afghanistan the resurgence of the Taliban and other groups, basically defeating them politically. So technologically, the United States might be far and above, more advanced than the groups that they're battling, but politically, they've been defeated already. So,
but that, so that in effect, also this the activity of urban warfare, which is where the U.S. forces, of course, are incapable of waging an effective battle because they have an entire country which is against them. What their solution is robotics, I presume, is to robotize
exactly.
That process.
Exactly. They, you know, they believe that through advanced sensor technology and, you know, battlefield tools, they'll be able to defeat insurgencies, no matter where they are, let's say.
Well, I'll have to interrupt you because we're at the end of the program.
All right, Michelle.
We thank our guest, Tom Burkhardt, who has joined us from San Francisco. Fabulous analysis. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Professor Peter Phillips. Bye for now. Thanks, Tom.
Thank
Join
you.
Us after the break.